Good afternoon, and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon. And we take your calls for an hour if you want to call in with questions about the Bible or maybe disagreement with the host on something that has been said here previously or that you'll hear today. Feel free to disagree. We invite you to call and balance comment if you do. The number to call is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. For those of you living in the Santa Cruz area, I've been mentioning from time to time that I'm coming up there in a couple of weeks. I'll be there on the weekend of the 17th and the 18th and the 19th. Maybe longer. I don't know. It depends on how many things get lined up. But on the 17th, on Friday, I'm speaking in Soquel, and those of you who are local Christians in the Santa Cruz area may remember the old Lighthouse Church that used to be an old theater in Soquel. I'm going to be speaking there Friday night, 7 o'clock. The next night at 7 o'clock, I'm teaching at the Vets Hall in Santa Cruz, and then the next morning, I think it's Redwood Christian Center up in Felton, I'll be speaking Sunday morning. So that's what we've got so far. I think I'm free on Sunday night. I would certainly consider Thursdays or Mondays as possible openings if you want to line something up. All the speaking places that I will be found at our website, thenarrowpath.com, under announcements. And that's coming up in a couple of weeks now. All right, and we're going to go to the phones right now and talk to Kathy from Minnesota. Kathy, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Oh, hi. Last week you had mentioned that there wasn't that many places in the Bible that mentioned the word heaven.
And, heaven?
Heaven.
Well, let me clarify what I said. I said the word heaven appears a lot. It appears as the place where God is, where the angels are, and things like that. What we don't find is many references to Christians going to heaven when they die. So I don't want you to think I said something different. You can look in a concordance and find lots of occurrences of the word heaven in the New Testament, but you will not find
many. Yeah, that's what I did.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, and there's a lot of them, but did you notice how the word is being used? It talks about our Father in heaven, which that's God, is mm-hmm. in heaven. The angels of heaven are mentioned. There's lots of things that happen from heaven and so forth. What I'm talking about is the destiny of righteous people when they die is very seldom mentioned as heaven. But go ahead.
Oh, I see. No, well, anyways, I looked it up and there was 700 some in the Old Testament and 200 and some in the New Testament.
Right. Yeah, you find the word heaven a lot of times. It's like you know, when we're talking about Israel, there's different opinions about the state of Israel today. Sometimes people who have a certain opinion say, well, the word Israel is found 2,000 times in the Bible, therefore we're right. But, of course, mm-hmm. the question is not how many times do you find the word. The question is, what is the word, how is the word being used? So in the Old Testament, for example, you say there's, 700, 800 cases where the word heaven occurs. But the word heaven...
700.
Yeah, 700. There's not even one case I know of in the Old Testament where the word heaven refers to the place where people go when they die. It's the place where God is, where his angels are, where the stars are, where the rain falls from, where fire comes down from in the time of Elijah comes down from heaven. In other words, heaven is a place that is often mentioned. It is simply not mentioned as a place where people go when they die. And likewise, in the New Testament, probably over 20-something times, the word heaven appears in Matthew alone, in the term the kingdom of heaven, which is not referring to heaven as a place that we go when we die. Jesus was referring to the kingdom of God, which is a different concept. Jesus often refers to our Father in heaven, which again refers to heaven, but not as a place, specifically any mention of going there. Now, the New Testament does say we go to heaven when we die, but it doesn't say it in the term, using the term heaven. What it says is that when we die, we are absent from the body and present with the Lord. Well, we know where the Lord is. He's in heaven. So we can say, okay, so when we die, we get to go to be with Jesus in heaven for the time being until he comes back. But even then, the word heaven doesn't appear in the passage as a place we go to. But of course, it's talking about heaven. But what I've said is that you don't really find the Bible mentioning very much heaven as a place where people go when they die. Although the word appears, as you point out very well, almost 1,000 times in the Bible, just not used that, just not used that way.
Okay.
I appreciate you looking it up. Hey, God bless you. I'm glad that when I say something and someone thinks, well, that doesn't sound right, that you go and look it up. That's an excellent thing to do, because if I say something that's incorrect, I don't want to leave you with a mistaken notion. So I really would encourage you all to be like the Bereans. When Paul preached in Berea, it says the people heard him gladly, but they searched the scriptures daily to see if these things are so. And it says they were noble to do that. And I certainly want anybody who hears me say something that they think, I'm not sure that's biblical, you go for it. Look it up. Try to find out. If I'm wrong, don't believe me. But even if I'm right and you're mistaken, it doesn't really matter. It's a good thing that you looked instead of just trusting some guy you hear on the radio. Don't ever just trust some guy you hear on the radio. Do your own study. And that's what Kathy did. I appreciate that, Kathy. I commend you for that. Thank you for joining us. Let's talk to Ward from Oregon. Ward, welcome.
Thank you. Been a long time.
It has been, yeah. You used to call years ago. Yeah.
Yeah. Yesterday I had two lovely ladies from Africa at my door, Jehovah's Witnesses.
Uh-huh.
They may be coming back, and I want to be prepared. I want to be kind and loving, which I was yesterday, but I want to be accurate as well. Would you say that their doctrine, their critical flaw is the deity of Christ?
I think their denial of the deity of Christ is probably the most severe theological problem they have. It's not the only one. They don't accept the Trinity at all. They don't believe the Holy Spirit is a person in the Godhead. Believe he's God's active force. They don't believe Jesus is equal to God or that he is God. They believe he's a creation of God. These are problems, obviously, in their theology, where they are, their views, in my opinion, are unbiblical. But even apart from that, when you're dealing with the Jehovah's Witnesses, you have to be aware of another thing that's going on. I mean, you can show them all the verses you want to that prove that Jesus is God, and there's plenty of them you can use, but it'll make no impact on them at all, not even a little bit. It'll just be like water off a duck's back. And you say, what in the world is wrong with these people? I'm showing them what the Bible says and they don't see it. Well, there's a deeper issue that prevents that from being very fruitful. And that is, they are part of a cult. And by definition, what I call a cult is a religious organization which tells people what they're allowed to think and what they're not allowed to think. In other words, they're not free. They're not free to study the Bible and reach their own conclusions. If they do that, they'll be kicked out of the group. The group is considered to be the prophet of God, as collectively. The Watchtower Society identifies itself as the prophet of God. And the only way you're going to be saved is if you submit to the teaching of the prophet of God. Now, the kind of people who join cults are different kind of people than you and me. I don't want somebody to do my thinking for me. I want to study the Bible. I want to think for myself. I want to reach conclusions between me and God, because I'm going to answer to God for what I conclude, and therefore I want to make sure that I'm not letting somebody else, I'm not going to shuffle that responsibility off on someone else. You think for me and tell me what to think. Now, there are people who do that and want to do that. I'm not one of them, and I don't think you're one of them. So it's very hard to get through to them, because it's not just that they have unbiblical theology. It's that they're not allowed to change their theology. Even if it is unbiblical, they have to go with the group. Now, of course, there are sometimes Jehovah's Witnesses will come to your door And once in a while, there's one that's a very new convert to their movement. And a lot of times this is how it is. An older JW comes along with a younger one and is kind of mentoring them in this door-to-door indoctrination enterprise. And I have sometimes found that talking to them, especially if I address my remarks to the younger one, that they're not fully indoctrinated yet. They're not fully brainwashed yet. And sometimes it appears that I may be, you know, some of the points I'm making are getting through to them a bit. Unfortunately, when they leave my house, the older one's going to try to undo all of that. And the main thing is that a cultist is somebody who doesn't realize that you can have a relationship with God yourself and you're responsible to God for your beliefs. A cultist is somebody who says, tell me who's right. Tell me what they want me to say so I'll be right with God and I'll just go along with it. It's hard for you and me to think of someone even having that mentality, but every cultist has it. That's what a cultist is. A cultist is somebody. A cultist is someone who has voluntarily surrendered their freedom of thought to an organization or a person who's a cult leader, and that's what Jehovah's Witnesses do. Therefore, no matter what scriptures you show them, you can show them that their views are wrong. You can go. They'll go. I've been hours with them. I spent a couple hours in the home of one of the 144,000, as they see him, one of the anointed ones, they call him. And, I was able to refute everything he said, but he didn't notice it. You know, these guys are brainwashed. And you may find that there's somebody there who comes who's not thoroughly brainwashed because they're new at it, and you may get through. Or there's even something possibly better, and that is show them the love of Christ, which is something they don't know much about. They don't believe you can have a personal relationship with God. They believe that being loyal to the organization is what God is requiring of you. And if you even testify to how Jesus changed your life, how you were, you know, when you came to Christ, what he means to you now, how your life has changed, what he's done in your life, all of this will be like speaking a foreign language to them. They don't believe that God interacts with you. They don't believe that you have a personal relationship with Jesus. It's a foreign language to them. But it may be something that makes them hungry for that. They say, what? Is that a possibility? In which case, they may search for God and find him. But the problem is when people have been satisfied to have a relationship with an organization. And by the way, some Christians in Protestant denominations and Catholics have this very flaw also. They're willing to let their pastor or their priest or the Pope or someone else do their thinking for them. And they don't really have a relationship with God in the sense that we think of the term. They have a relationship with an organization. And that's what cults are. That's what the Watchtower Society does to them. So just know that when they come to your house, they've got some doctrines that need correction. And the scriptures are there to correct them. But you'll be amazed how many of those scriptures you can show them and they will not see it. It's like their eyes are glazed over. They're not allowed to see it that way. They know those scriptures, by the way, because they are trained before they come to your house. They sit in training sessions where they're told what you are going to say to them because they know they've got over 100 years of experience of arguing with people like you and me. They know what you're going to say and they're told why you're wrong and what they should say. In other words, they're programmed to reject what you have to say. And I'm not saying you shouldn't show them the scripture, shouldn't tell them the truth. I'm just saying don't be surprised if it doesn't have the impact on them that it would have on an open-minded person, you know?
Yes. Well, thank you. So, you know, I've known that pretty much word for word what you're saying. I just wanted to be refreshed. One thing I did notice, the tremendous love I had for them, I took them by the hand and just wanted to receive them. And I later felt that's what they needed more than anything else, just to know the love of Christ that I sensed for them. I didn't know they were Jehovah's Witnesses at first. Uh-huh. They caught me off guard. And
I agree with you. They are lovely people in many cases, very lovely people. And it's how can you not love them? I mean, they are sincere. They're sincerely trying to serve God. They're probably doing better at their religion than we're doing at ours, you know, but it's just, that's what it is for them. It's a religion and it's an affiliation with a group And that's what they're counting on. And you can't help but you know, pity them and love them and reach out to them. Don't see them as adversaries. See them
as someone who
needs, you know, the sick who need a physician. Yeah.
Well, Steve, thank you so much. I so appreciate you over many years. I was there in 1970 when you were probably in the same first little chapel when Lonnie Frisbee spoke. I was there. You were there. I didn't know you.
Maybe we sat next to each other.
Yeah, we could have. I'm 17 years older than you. You were just a kid.
Yep.
But we were there together with Chuck and Lonnie in the little chapel, even before the big tent.
So, yeah, I remember those days. Well, thanks for your call, Ward. I hope this is helpful.
Thank you.
Just
thank
love
you.
Them.
Thank you. Okay. Thanks
and
so
testify.
Much, my brother.
Testify to your experience with Christ. God bless you, brother. Okay, this caller is either Mitchell or Michael or Michelle. It's not spelled like any of those normally. Hello, welcome from Denver, Colorado.
Yeah, hi, Steve. This is Michael in Denver, Colorado. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Good to have
awesome.
You.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Well, thank you for taking my call. It's great to be with you. Real quick question, and I'll take my answer off the air. So what I was going to ask about is the similarities between the flood described in the Epic of Gilgamesh, which is actually one of the oldest written stories on earth.
Right.
It comes from ancient Sumeria. It was written on 12 clay tablets. And the biblical account of the Great Flood, you know, I know there's been a lot of experts that have kind of compared the flood stories in the Gilgamesh epic and the story about Noah's Ark. You know, they seem to find a lot of similarities between the two accounts. I was going to ask, have you looked at some of the commonalities between the Gilgamesh account of the Great Flood and the biblical account? And do you think they could potentially be one and the same?
Yes, absolutely. I think they're the same flood. In fact, many nations, many countries around the world, ancient societies have flood stories too. You know, as far from Israel as South America and South Africa and other places very far away from Israel, ancient civilizations have this story of a flood that covered the earth. And of course, the reason they do is because there was one, and all nations have descended from those who survived it. That is, the Bible says all nations have come from the three sons of Noah. And there's every reason to believe that's true. And the Gilgamesh epic is, as you say, the oldest known written account of the flood. And, you know, it comes from a pagan source, but it has some points of overlap with the biblical story. A global flood, a few people saved in a boat, and animals and so forth. But it's different in some features. For example, the size and shape of the ark is different than in Noah's story in the Bible. And there'll be other differences too, of course, because as a story is retold and retold through the generations, even a true story, it takes on the character of the storytellers. And therefore, by the time the Gilgamesh epic was written, which was a long time, or at least, yeah, considerable time before Moses wrote Genesis, the flood was already pretty much ancient history, you know. So in the time that the Sumerians were writing the Gilgamesh epic about the flood, it had been hundreds, if not thousands of years since the flood. That being so, the story had changed. And it did in other places, too, because, again, the three sons of Noah and their offspring traveled and settled around the world, and therefore the retelling of the story evolved in different places, in different ways, so that as you go to these different ancient writings, the Aztecs and others, you find that you know, the story is the same flood, but different details, same basic idea. And that's what you would expect to happen over thousands of years of retelling a story that was remembered by your ancestors, but has been embellished different ways. Now, the question then is not what is the oldest account that has survived, what is the most accurate account that has survived? And we have reason to believe that the flood account in the Bible is the most accurate version. In finding something like the Gilgamesh epic, it only confirms that there was a flood like that which is described in the Bible. Although, again, the Bible's details are different than the details in some respects of the Gilgamesh epic. But that's, again, what you'd expect. Different societies telling their legends and their stories in isolation from each other, they're gonna evolve differently. But the question is, how do we know the biblical one is correct? Well, for one thing, the book of Genesis was written by Moses, who was a prophet of God. We don't know of anyone else who was a prophet of God who ever wrote a flood story. I mean, the legends may be told by sages and historians and you know, religious people of pagan religions, but Moses was a prophet of God, and God spoke to him face to face, and so we can pretty much trust Moses' credibility, whatever he writes, as being much more likely to be, you know, agreeable with what God said than what any pagan sources would say about the same subject. More than that, there's evidence that Moses used pre-existing documents in writing Genesis. The word toledoth, a Hebrew word toledoth, appears several times in Genesis, I think about 11 times or so. And the word toledoth in the King James Version was translated the generations of Abram, the generations of Isaac, the generations of this or that person. And scholars typically believe that these references to these toledoths are punctuating different documents, that the toledoth of Noah or his sons, for example, could have been written and preserved by Noah's sons, and their names are put on it for that reason. It's their test, their history. The word toledoth can mean history of or genealogy of or several different things, the story of. And the names that are on these toledoths, and they are still found in Genesis. If you just look up the word generations or whatever. Sometimes the English translations translate the same word different ways. Sometimes it says generations. Sometimes it says the history of, where the Hebrew in every case is saying toledoth of. But the point I'm making is that many scholars believe, and I think there's evidence of it, that Moses had these various documents written by Noah and his sons, written by Abraham, written by these people who are the authors of these documents. And Moses had them because they were preserved by the line of Shem. Shem was one of the sons of Noah that came off the ark. And descended from Shem was Abraham. And descended from Abraham was Moses. And that this, you know, the flood story as told by Shem was no doubt passed down through the line that included Abraham, and from there passed down through the line that included Moses and the Israelites. And when Moses wrote Genesis, he was using these ancient records. They were family records for the Jews. And we have every reason to believe, since Moses was a prophet too, that God's inspiration was playing a role in this. So there's no reason to think that any account of the flood is more accurate than the biblical account, though there's reason to believe that the biblical account is, insofar as it is agreeable with any other record, confirmed by them. I'm happy that there's a flood story in the Epic of Gilgamesh. I'm glad there's flood stories in other societies too, because you'd expect that. I mean, if everybody dates back to the survivors of the ark who went through the flood, you'd expect their ancestors to have told the story of the flood, and every society in the world would know it. If there wasn't a worldwide flood, and let's just say some of the societies in the world today had no dealings with the flood or its survivors, because it was, let's say, a local flood in one area and not the whole world, well, then how is it that all these societies remember there was a flood? Although they've, you know, the details have been changed through the retelling, I believe that Moses, in writing Genesis, had records from the horse's mouth, as it were. And besides that, God was inspiring him. So those are my thoughts about the Gilgamesh epic and its similarities to the flood story in the Bible. To my mind, it's very helpful to have these parallel accounts, even though they don't confirm every detail. They certainly confirm the major idea of a flood. This is sort of like, it's very similar to having the different accounts of the resurrection appearances of Christ. You've got four Gospels that tell the story of Christ, and they all tell of not only the resurrection, but the appearances of Christ after the resurrection, with the exception of Mark. The short ending of Mark doesn't record any, the longer endings do, but But Matthew and Luke and John certainly give numerous details of sightings of Jesus, meetings with Jesus by the disciples after he rose from the dead. But they don't all give the same details. In fact, in some cases, it's very hard to harmonize the account of one gospel with that of another. I say it's hard, although I have found it possible to do. I've been able to take, not just me, others have too. I can take all the details in all the gospels and put them in a chronological order that makes sense. So, you know, there's no reason to believe that any of the gospels have any inaccurate information. But even if someone doubted that this can be done, even if some people thought, well, I think Matthew, you know, he's got a few stories in there, maybe it didn't really happen, or maybe Luke does or John. If someone took that position, the fact remains that even if the stories are not the same in detail, they all record the same fact. Namely, and they do so independently. That's the great thing. These are independent accounts. It's not like they conspired together to write a fake account, or else they would have gotten it. They would have gotten it the same. These are independently written accounts, and they all testify to one important event, and that is the resurrection of Jesus Christ and the fact that he was seen by many after he rose from the dead. So, you know, regardless of how different accounts may differ on details, having numerous accounts that basically confirm the same big thing, like a flood or like the resurrection of Christ, makes it a very strong story, a very well-attested story. Hey, I need to take a break. I appreciate your call. You're listening to The Narrow Path. We have another half hour coming up, so don't go away. The Narrow Path is listener-supported. If you'd like to help us stay on the air, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Or you can go to our website, take anything you want for free. You can donate if you want at thenarrowpath.com. I'll be back in 30 seconds.
If you enjoy the Narrow Path radio program, you'd really like the resources at our website, thenarrowpath.com, where hundreds of biblical lectures and messages by our host, Steve Gregg, can be accessed without charge and listened to at your convenience. If you have not done so, visit the website, thenarrowpath.com, and discover all that is available for your learning pleasure.
Welcome back to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're going into our second half hour. We're taking your calls if you have questions about the Bible. I'm looking at a switchboard very different than in our first half hour. We went into the program with all our lines on the switchboard full. Right now, most of them are not full, and that means you could get through probably if you call right now. That may not be possible, say, 5-10 minutes from now. So this is the time to call if you want to. The number is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. Chris from Maine is our next caller. Hi, Chris. Welcome.
Thanks. How's it going?
Fine, thanks.
Just had one thing and then a question I want to ask you. I just want to ask everyone listening to be praying for Portland, Maine, and be praying for our church to be effective in spreading the gospel here. And second, I wanted to ask you what your thoughts are on the different text types of Greek manuscripts, the Alexandrian and Byzantine text types. I'm not sure if you've looked into them that much, but just curious on what your thoughts were for those.
Sure. I'll be glad to. Sure, and I'd also like to encourage our listeners to pray for your church. I don't know your church, but you're in Maine. Yeah, the New England states are pretty spiritually hard to crack with the gospel. So we do desire and pray for your church to be effective. As far as the various text types or the different manuscript families of the New Testament in Greek, there's a variety of families of manuscripts. We have over 5,000 Greek manuscripts of the New Testament, and I believe we have about 8,000 early translations into Latin from the Greek. So we have a lot of early records of what the New Testament said when it came from the hand of its writers. The Greek manuscripts, of course, are probably the most important because it was originally written in Greek, but they don't, as I was talking to our previous caller about, you know, when a story is retold and retold and retold, sometimes details get changed. The same thing is true when you copy a manuscript through centuries. You know, one person's copying it and they, you know, accidentally make some kind of a mistake. They miscopy something, misspell something, leave a word out, don't realize they did it, and they pass it along. The next copyist copies their mistake. And therefore, the new copy is, you know, is flawed in some small way. And the new copier may actually make another mistake or two that he doesn't realize. So over the many generations of copying these manuscripts, little mistakes accumulate. And therefore, you know, by the time, you know, it's, say, 200-300 years after the manuscripts were written, and we don't have the earliest copies, but we do have manuscripts from, say, 300 years later, we find that the manuscripts may have, you know, a little bit of difference. We don't know what it all is because we don't have the earlier ones to compare with. But when you get to manuscripts, let's say, 150 years later than those, you do see some differences between the earliest ones and the next batch. And, of course, these manuscripts have been in production for 2,000 years, so there are Greek manuscripts that have been copied from the originals throughout the whole period since the New Testament was written. So some manuscripts are going to be now, looking back, 1,000-year-old manuscripts. Some are going to be 700 years old. Some are going to be 500 years old, and so forth. And so what you find in these, you know, altogether there's like 5,000 of these manuscripts floating around, is they don't all agree with each other word for word. What you also find is they agree with each other very remarkably, because the people who copied them were conscientious, and they didn't like having mistakes. They wanted to be accurate. But human error does enter in. But fortunately, since these are sacred documents that most people who were copying them wanted to preserve rather than change, the changes have been much less than you'd expect in 2,000 years of copying. Now, among all the different manuscripts and their different, you know, their different readings of certain passages, which none of which are very significant differences, but there's the earliest manuscripts we usually call the Alexandrian text, which would include the Sinaiticus and the Vaticanus and the Alexandrinus texts. These are produced in Alexandria, Egypt, and they represent the earliest text type. That is, they are all pretty much the same as each other, and they also come from the earliest period of any of the manuscripts that have survived, and they belong to probably the earlier middle 4th century, that is the 300s AD. Then there's a gap, probably of a century of more or more, and then there's a bunch more manuscripts, and so these, in many cases, are of different text types. Sometimes they're called the Byzantine text. They have, you know, marks of the Byzantine churches, you know, copying of them, and as you get further, much further down to the time of the Reformation, you have what we call the Textus Receptus. Now, what the Textus Receptus is what was called an eclectic text. And what that means is a guy named Erasmus was commissioned by the Catholic Church to produce the best possible Greek manuscripts of the New Testament using the best available Greek manuscripts that there were. Now, he didn't have anywhere near as many as we do. We're talking about, you know, 500-600 years ago. And many of the manuscripts have been found since then. So we might have a 5,000 or so Greek manuscripts now. He only had a couple handful of texts. So what he was to do is see the differences in these texts and try to assess which reading, let's just say you had five different readings of the same verse in different manuscripts. Well, he was supposed to choose the best reading of every verse based on how early a given reading was witnessed to, how many of the better manuscripts read it that way instead of another way and so forth. It's quite a science. It's called textual criticism. And Erasmus took these texts and he created what was called an eclectic text, which he went through the whole text of all the manuscripts he had and tried to select what looked like the most accurate version of every verse in there. Now, by the way, even the ones that aren't identical didn't differ very much. It's not as if you could take the two manuscripts that differed from each other the most from each other and get different doctrines or a different gospel or something from them. No, the differences in these are usually inconsequential things. A word is left out that is obviously accidentally left out. A name is spelled wrong. The word order in a sentence is reversed, but it's the same sentence. You know, it's like those kinds of things. There's nothing like one manuscript teaches a certain doctrine and a different manuscript teaches an opposite doctrine. Nothing like that. In other words, even if we didn't have the Textus Receptus that Erasmus produced, we would be able to get all the same information from the New Testament that we get. But he used that and he produced this manuscript, which was used by the earliest modern translations into modern languages. Like Luther used the Textus Receptus to translate the Luther Bible into German. The older Spanish versions used it. The older French versions used it. The English, the King James Version, used it. That is, when the manuscripts began to be translated into modern languages, it was the Textus Receptus that Erasmus produced that was used. Now, what happened is, in more modern history, in the late 19th century, they began to discover manuscripts that were older than the ones that Erasmus used. And those were the Alexandrian texts I mentioned earlier. They began to find, late in modern times, they began to find these older manuscripts, only a few of them, not many. But there were differences between them and the Textus Receptus. So modern Bibles now, when they translate the New Testament, they use usually the Alexandrian text instead of the Textus Receptus. That means that the King James, which used the Textus Receptus, will in some verses differ than a modern translation that used the Alexandrian text. And this has concerned some people because they say, oh, we need a completely accurate text. We have to go with the Textus Receptus. Or we need a completely accurate text. We need to go with the Alexandrian text. And the truth is, if you think you have to have a word-for-word accurate text, we are in trouble because there are so many manuscripts and there are so many different places where there's slight changes in wording. No changing meaning, just changes in the way the sentence is structured or related. And if we have to have the exact reading from the original, well, we're just out of luck. But certain Christians who don't want to be out of luck and are demanding that we have a perfect original, they say, we're going to go with the Textus Receptus. We're going to go with the King James only because the Textus Receptus is the one that God preserved. Well, that's not true. The Textus Receptus was put together by a man, an uninspired man named Erasmus, who is putting together information from several different texts. There wasn't one manuscript called the Textus Receptus that was passed down from the time of the apostles. That was put together from lots of different manuscripts that differed from each other in small ways by this man, Erasmus, who's a Roman Catholic scholar. And it was used by Luther, it was used by King James translators, and so forth. Now, it's not a problem, at least to me, because I get the same doctrines on every subject. If I read the King James Version or the New King James, both which use the Textus Receptus, I'm going to get exactly the same teachings that if I use the New American Standard Version or NIV or the ESV or the Christian Standard Bible or any of the new ones, they use the Alexandrian text. Well, yeah, the word's going to be different in a few verses here and there, but no doctrine is going to be affected by it. And so, to me, I don't stress it. As if you want me to tell you which manuscripts are better, well, I'm not the scholar. The ones who are scholars don't all fully agree about that. And I'm more of a general Christian who knows the state of affairs. I can't tell you the, you know, which manuscripts are necessarily better. And if I chose one or the other, there'd be a lot of scholars who know the matter better than I do who disagree on the other side. So to me, what I can say authoritatively is, doesn't matter to me. I'm going to get the same teaching, the same Jesus, the same apostolic doctrines, no matter which of these manuscripts we use. And so I don't get upset, as some people do, from it. And that's my take on that particular issue that some people are so concerned about. Slavic from South Carolina, good to hear from you. Welcome to the Narrow Path. Hello? Slavic, if I don't hear you, I'm going to have to move on. You may be talking, but if so, it's not getting through. Oh, there you are. I hear a sound now. Are you there?
Oh, you hear me? Yes.
I do now. Yes, go ahead.
Sorry about that. Thank you for answering my question on Facebook today. Uh-huh. I guess this is my second question.
Okay.
My question is regarding... am I correct in thinking that the cup that Jesus was referring to before his crucifixion was not referring to the cup of God's wrath, but actually the cup of suffering that he was going to drink?
I don't think it's either or. I think it's both. Yeah, well, you're talking about the cup when Jesus... when John and James said, can we sit at the right hand and left hand of you, of your throne at your kingdom? He said, well, can you drink the cup I have to drink of? And they said, yes. And he said, well, you will drink the cup that I have to drink of, but I can't tell you whether you'll sit at my right and left hand. That's the Father's decision. And then when Jesus was in the garden praying, he said, Father, if it's possible, let this cup pass from me. And then when he was arrested and Peter tried to rescue Jesus, Jesus said, put away your sword. The cup that my Father's given me, shall I not drink it? So you're asking, what is this cup? Is it the cup of suffering, or is it something else? First of all, it is the cup of suffering. He is talking about his death on the cross. He's talking about the things he has to suffer. But there's another concept of the cup, and I think you alluded to this too, the cup of wrath. In the Old Testament, for example, in Psalm 78, or it might be 75, there's a statement that says, there in the hand of the Lord, there's a cup. And it talks about how it's filled with his anger, and the wicked are going to have to drink from that cup. In Jeremiah 25, there's a reference to God giving Jeremiah in a vision a cup to take to the nations, and they had to drink it. It was the cup of God's wrath. The idea is there's this imagery in the Bible that every nation, as it were, has a cup to fill with their bad deeds. The sins they commit add to the filling of that cup. And once that cup is full, it's poured out on them in wrath by God. And that imagery is what is also found in the New Testament. In Revelation chapter 14, it says, he that worships the beast or takes the number of his name, you know, it will drink of the cup of God's wrath, which is poured out, or they'll drink of the wrath of God, which is pulled out full measure into the cup of his indignation, I think is how it's worded. And it's basically the cup of God's wrath. Now, Jesus even said to the Jews in Matthew 23, your fathers killed the prophets, but you're going to fill up the measure of your fathers. As the, you know, the cup of wrath was being filled up by the disobedience of your fathers. And now you're going to fill that cup up by killing me, and it's going to be poured out on you. Now, therefore, the consistent imagery of the cup in the Bible, both Old and New Testament, is it's the cup of God's wrath poured out on sin. Now, when Jesus said, Father, if it's possible, let this cup pass from me, he certainly was talking about his suffering. But I think it's implying that his suffering is the absorption of the wrath of God on behalf of man, that the sins of the world needed to be redressed by the wrath of God. And by the way, the wrath of God, I'm not going to go into the subject of how angry God was emotionally. Certainly wrath means anger, but there's a lot of anthropomorphisms in this. It's, you know, God's anger isn't just like he's losing his temper or flying off the handle. His anger toward a nation or toward a people is often seen in the destruction that comes upon them. But that doesn't mean that he doesn't love them or that he wouldn't rather they'd repented. But simply the manifestation of his wrath is the just punishment that he has no choice but to bring on those whom justice calls for it. And so that, you know, the wrath of God, the punishment for sin, was due to mankind. And I believe, some people don't believe this view of the atonement, I do, that the wrath of God was poured into the cup and Jesus drank it, that he had to drink the wrath of God, which the Bible so often speaks of in these terms. So I think you asked, is it the cup of wrath or is it the cup of his suffering? I don't think it's either or. I think the cup of his suffering was, I think his suffering was the wrath being poured out, and he was drinking it for the sins of mankind. And that's my understanding of that particular imagery.
Yeah, I asked because Jesus told James and John that they too will drink the cup. Would that not mean that they also had part in the atonement? I mean, and that does sound ridiculous, right? Or no?
Well, that would be ridiculous. Yeah, I mean, the drinking of the cup definitely means that they'll share in his suffering. And, you know, I mean, that is, they will suffer as he did. They will also die for their testimony. But obviously you're correct. I mean, them drinking that cup isn't the same, doesn't have the same significance of, you know, atoning for the sins of the world. Although Paul did say in Colossians chapter 1 that his own sufferings in some respects were making up for what was lacking in the sufferings of Christ for the sake of the church, he said. And that's a peculiar statement. But I think what he's speaking of there is that Christ's suffering was for the, you know, the payment for the for forgiveness, but Paul and the apostles' suffering was for the propagating of that forgiveness to the world. They went out and they suffered because they evangelized the world. That's what caused their suffering. They were persecuted. But yeah, I don't think that when he says you'll drink the cup I will be drinking of, that he's saying everything about your death will be as significant as mine. I mean, the disciples, for the most part, did all die as martyrs, John perhaps the exception. But we would suggest their death is significant, but it doesn't have the same significance Jesus did. But I think what he's saying is, I'm going to have to drink the cup of suffering, which, of course, in Jesus' case, is unique importance. But they're going to have to drink the cup of suffering like he does, but without the implication that they have the same significance or the same impact.
Yeah.
All right. Your line is pretty loud. I'm moving on to another call just because I have only less than 10 minutes left and there's a lot of people waiting, but I appreciate your call. Let's talk next to Tina from Surrey, British Columbia, Canada. Hi, Tina.
Hi. I have a two-part question. Will there be children on the new earth, and will women still be getting pregnant on the new earth? And I'll take my question off the air.
Okay. I don't believe there will be, because Jesus said in the resurrection, people will not marry. Now, the only context in which children come into the world in this present age is through marriage and sexual relations. We don't know of any alternative way that would be so in the new earth. Now, there may be mysteries untold that we have no concept of, but I don't believe there'll be marriage or reproduction. After our bodies are resurrected, as Jesus said, there won't be marriage. And because no marriage, I would suspect no reproduction either. But, you know, if there is reproduction without marriage, I have no idea. And I have my doubts, obviously. But we don't know. We're not told about that specifically. Some people would go to Isaiah 65, verses 17 to the end of the chapter to say, see, there are children there in the new heavens, the new earth. There it says a child shall die at 100 years old, and so forth. It even says in Isaiah 11 that the child shall play at the cobra's den and it will not be hurt. And people sometimes apply these passages either to a future millennium after Jesus comes back or to the new earth. I personally think these are symbolic descriptions to be spiritualized. Many of the verses in these passages are quoted by the New Testament authors, and they spiritualize them, and they apply them to the age of the church rather than to a future millennium or new heavens and new earth. So I'm going to go with the apostles on this. I'm going to say these are symbolic descriptions of spiritual realities in the body of Christ in the present age. That's my understanding. My lectures on these verses can be heard verse by verse from the website for free if you'd like a more full treatment of that idea. Gary from Philadelphia, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. I came upon your show a couple of weeks ago, and I enjoy listening to your radio station. And I got a question about something you were talking about earlier, about other stories about the flood and Noah's Ark.
Go ahead.
And a thought came into my mind. Does that mean that there were survivors of the Noah's Ark other than the people on the Ark?
No, there were not. No, the Bible says very specifically that all flesh and everything that had breath on the earth died in the flood. And then when Noah and his three sons and their wives came out of the ark, it says from these three, the whole earth was populated. And so all of the people everywhere on the planet are descended from Noah and his three sons.
Right. Well, I don't know how they got to write these other stories then. If it must have took a little time from the original.
Oh, I'm sure
ark.
It did. I'm sure it did. I mean, the cuneiform tablets that contain Gilgamesh epic that we're talking about do not date from any time really near the flood. They're older accounts of the flood than we have in Genesis. But the accounts in Genesis were written 1,500 years after the flood itself. So if the cuneiform texts were, let's say, 500 years earlier than that, that's still 1,000 years after the flood. And 1,000 years, stories can definitely be embellished in the retelling, especially if they're not written down until considerably later. All right, let's talk to Thomas from Mission Viejo, California. Welcome. We only have a couple minutes, I'm sorry to say.
Hey there, Steve. Thanks for taking my call. Little background. I've been a Christian for 56 years, and my question is, can you tell me about speaking in tongues? Because I have never had any of the pastors or small group leaders ever use this, what I would call conceited display of faith.
Well, there are some groups like Pentecostals who feel that speaking in tongues is a necessary evidence of being filled with the Spirit. In fact, some Pentecostal groups would say it's even an evidence of being saved. So they would suggest only people who speak in tongues are saved. The Bible doesn't teach that at all. The Bible does teach that speaking in tongues is a gift of the Holy Spirit. And we read in the Bible that many people, we don't read of this of all of them, but many people, when they got filled with the Spirit, also spoke in tongues. And in some cases, they prophesied too. This happened to many people, and I believe it still happens to many people when they're filled with the Spirit. But the Bible nowhere says this is necessary to happen. And therefore, in some traditions, the Pentecostal traditions, if you don't speak in tongues, you will either be suspected of not being saved or at least not being filled with the Spirit. The Bible doesn't give any basis for that assumption. Paul said, do all speak with tongues? Implying, no, they don't. But he did say, I wish you all spoke with tongues. So he said, that's a good thing. It's a good thing to speak in tongues, but everyone doesn't do it. And so it's one of those things that, you know, I believe that many people do speak in tongues and many people do not, but you can't really judge a person's spirituality by whether they do or don't. And Paul even said in 1 Corinthians 13, if I spoke in tongues, and he's talking about the gift of tongues, he says, if I speak in tongues of men and of angels, but if I don't have love, I'm just a noisy gong. I'm worth nothing. And so he's saying love is what makes, love is the mark of a spiritual person, not speaking in tongues. But speaking in tongues is not a bad thing. Let me just suggest, if you want a thorough teaching on this subject, go to my website, thenarrowpath.com. Look under topical lectures, and there's a series called Charisma and Character. You can listen to that lecture for free. It's a series of lectures, but you'll see lectures there about tongues, and I do cover it more thoroughly. Also, there's another website, Matthew713.com, that has a topical listing of calls previously on the program. If you look up speaking in tongues, you'll find lots of previous calls where I had more time to talk about it than I did today. I'm out of time, I'm sorry to say. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are live Monday through Friday. We are listener supported. If you want to help us out, you can donate from the website or just take the free stuff that's there, which is everything there. That's thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Let's talk again tomorrow.